Hello there, and welcome to this week's episode of the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm Hale, and with me again is Brandon. For today, we've got for once in a while, we've got quite a current philosopher, Byung-Chul Han, who's kind of, I don't want to call him pop philosophy. I don't think that that's like fair to him. I say that because in my very humble opinion, what the level of pop philosophy has gotten so low
pop philosophy is very much so like philosophy sort of conduited through popular media. Byung-Chul Han doesn't really like a little bit like Zizek, he'll reference and, you know, you pull case studies from popular media, but he doesn't use it as his canvas per se, like popular, you know, like the philosophy of Batman or something.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. Just as an aside, already getting into it for our listeners, I think to me there's two different types of pop philosophy. There's philosophy that is focused more on pop culture type stuff, and then there's like the reverse where pop culture sort of produces ostensibly philosophical creators' interests. The most obvious one is like the obsession with stoicism that's like going on the last like 10 years, where like every kind of like popular YouTuber is like doing videos on stoicism and stuff like that. So Byung-Chul Han is a serious philosopher, but he deals more with current topics. He deals a lot with media and social relations. And we're doing a reading episode for a few listeners, just so you know. We're looking at his most recent work. It's quite short. It's more like an extended essay. It's called The Crisis of Narration. And we're just going to read the preface and basically discuss it and have a little bit of a discussion about the preface as it kind of covers a lot of the most general themes of the book. But before we do that, let's open up with our quote and quandary section. I know you brought a quote. Do you want to select your quote first?
Sure. Yeah, I can select my quote. So this is from an essay by Bertrand Russell. Actually, I have an enormous tome, The Basic Writings of Bertrand Russell. I'm not super invested in reading his philosophy or anything, but he is very well written. He has a lot of interesting things to say. He's quite insightful. But this is from an essay called The Function of a Teacher, and it is the first sentence of the concluding paragraph where he says, "The teacher, like the artist, the philosopher, and the man of letters, can only perform his work adequately if he feels himself to be an individual directed by an inner creative impulse, not dominated and fettered by an outside authority." Mm-hmm, yeah, so there's some, I think that two of the main things that I find interesting in this is that, first of all, Bertrand Russell is ranking the teacher, the artist, the philosopher, and the man of letters next to one another. So there's some relationship, there's some like essential relationship between an artist, a creative person, a man of letters, so someone who writes essays for public reading and whatnot. And their common theme is this inner creative impulse, which necessitates being an individual. So I find that very interesting. I found it interesting considering that so much of, and maybe we can maybe touches on what we'll be talking about today, that the history of philosophy is such a history of individuals. But of course, a good chunk of the early philosophy was schools, right? So that this sort of evolution towards that, it's not always been that way. You can think of the Pythagorean cult. If it had Pythagoras at its center, well, it was still a school. The Epicureans were still a school, right?
I thought what stood out to me at all your points were, as usual, were totally interesting. What stood out to me, though, was this idea that, like, you know, is passing along knowledge, is teaching possible in an authoritarian setup, and not just with like with teacher to student, but more like if a teacher, if what is taught is directly and very seriously imposed by some outside force, like say whether it be a religiosity or the state or whatever it's going to be, then what is the function of the teacher still the same? Is the teacher still teaching? Is the teacher still passing along knowledge? Or is it more like a transfer of already delineated information, which is something that I think we're going to actually talk about Byung Chul Han, so it ties it nicely. I'm still trying to, but I get the sense it's like there could be a claim made, like it's like say something like, I always use this example, but I use it like in the Third Reich, were teachers really teaching when they were given their like strict code of what to not talk about? Primarily, I think what's that way is it's like, because you're not allowing knowledge and that transfer and that understanding and that learning to have any kind of flexibility, both in the transfer from teacher to student. And it's basically like, if there's all sorts of places that you can't go or you can't talk about, right, then what are you actually giving to the student?
Right, yeah. There's that famous line in the Plato's Republic that says that nothing taught by force stays in the soul. Now, that word force is, interestingly, where we get the word bias, force in Greek being bias. So any kind of compulsion, you have to teach this, it's not really teaching, right? Specifically, especially in the allegory of the cave, where Socrates talks about how teaching is not just putting stuff in empty heads. It's the periagoge. It's the turnabout of the soul.
I'm sorry, listeners, but my quote always ends up being more like an excerpt or something. I got to find shorter quotes. That's my goal for next week. But I found, especially with considering what we're going to talk about today, which is like, again, we're going to talk a lot about transfer of understanding and the media and all this kind of stuff. And how, you know, legends in particular, we'll get into it, but narratives really function and impart a story that sort of writes our lives and our worlds. We'll get into that more with the extra writing. But this is actually from later in Byung Chul Han's book, Crisis of Narration. It's an excerpt of a Jewish Hasidic tale about the transfer of knowledge, in this case, religious knowledge. But I thought it was really good. So I'll just read the little excerpt for all of you. When the Baal Shem had a difficult task before him, he would go to a certain place in the woods, light a fire, and meditate in prayer. And what he had set out to perform was done. So basically, is talking about the first generation of an ancient ritual being performed. And so Baal Shem had a difficult task before him. He would go to a certain place in the woods, certain place, light a fire, and meditate in prayer. And what he had set out to perform was done. When a generation later, the Magid of Meseritz was faced with the same task, he would go to the same place in the woods and say, "We can no longer light the fire, but we can still speak the prayers," and what he wanted done became a reality. Again, a generation later, Rabbi Moshe Leib of Sezov, sorry for butchering all these names, had to perform this task. And he too went into the woods and said, "We can no longer light a fire, nor do we know the secret meditations belonging to the prayer. But we do know the place in the woods to which it all belongs, and that must be sufficient," and sufficient it was. But when another generation had passed, and Rabbi Israel of Rishin had called upon to perform the task, he sat down on his golden chair in his castle and said, "We cannot light the fire, we cannot speak the prayers, we do not know the place, but we can tell the story of how it was done." And the storyteller adds, "The story which he told had the same effect as the actions of the other three generations." So I really liked, I think it's a good intro into our own topics today, but the importance of narration, the importance of story, and the importance of passing that on, but also how over generations these things can erode and get lost, And I also like how the end of the tale has him sitting in this golden chair. It's kind of like a reflection of, you know, with every sort of turn of the screw of this sort of narrative tale and the passing on of this knowledge and all this kind of stuff, that it's almost like the world gets a little bit more distant from its original place, right? So now we've got from a guy who knew all the stuff, who's out in the woods, he's doing the same, to now a guy who's in a big castle in a golden chair. Now, in this case, you know, he still is able to perform the acts because he knows the story. For the listeners, I'll say that Byung-Chul Han kind of adds after that excerpt, he explores that excerpt with us, that, you know, what happens when we forget the story, right? Like, all we have is the story left, all we have is the narrative. What happens when that goes away, right? You know, then you're no longer to really perform the acts.
And not just the story, but storytelling per se, which is, I think, what Byung-Chul Han is going to go into.
So that was our two quotes. I think both were kind of prescient for our reading today. But you know what? There's one more thing. We got a quandary. This is not, it's going to be a little bit related, but probably not so much. But I actually heard it today, and it was a perspective that I thought was really interesting, so I wanted to share with you and with the listeners. And it actually comes from Stephen Colbert, of all people. I didn't think I was going to be saying that on this episode. But I saw a very short clip, and we'll be talking about short clips and how great they are. I just wrote it to you. Where did I go? There we go. But I saw this very short clip, and I thought this was kind of an interesting quandary, an interesting thing to think about. It's basically separation of church and state has always been a big topic, and especially since the early modern period has been a really fundamental part of political philosophy, whether you're for or against it. What, you know, most cases it's against. I mean, that's most, we don't live in that many, there aren't that many theocracies around. There are some, but, you know, obviously a theocracy is a state where the church is embedded in the state in some kind of way or other. But, you know, usually when we talk about the separation of church and state, it's because we want to keep religion out of the state, out of the government, right? Like, we kind of say that religion has no place in the state. That's a personal matter. That's for your community or whatever, but not for the state. But, you know, Colbert brought up an interesting point that I had never thought about really before, which is he kind of says, you know, people talk about they want the separation of church and state, all this kind of stuff. And he's like, but I want the separation of church and state because I want the state out of my religion. I don't want the government involved in religion. And I thought that that was an interesting perspective. And I thought that he brought up, you know, I don't have the whole recording here, but he brought up interesting points, which is basically, you know, a religion is something that's often deeply communal, deeply personal, you know, has a whole series of traditions and ideologies and stuff that go along with it. You know, what happens when the state and particularly politics more generally get involved and directly involved in that? I think we have this vision that suddenly everyone becomes super religious in the state and all this kind of stuff. But the opposite could be true. And I think it's actually more likely where the state uses religion as a conduit to control people or persecute people or whatever it's going to be, right? You know, suddenly it's like, oh, well, if I have, you know, discriminatory, let's say, political beliefs, well, guess what? Religion could be a really useful way. Utilizing a religion could be a very useful way of legitimizing, you know, state acts of persecution, right? And then what that also does is it ends up sort of tainting the sanctity of one's religious life and religious experience, because it's no longer like, you know, a kind of ostensibly pure thing. It's very clearly now something that's leveraged by the government. So I thought that was a really interesting take, and not one I had heard before, even though it's like so obvious. So yeah, I just wanted to share that as like a neat little example from Colbert of all
people. Yeah, that's interesting. It's these kinds of like insightful flips that, you don't really think about until someone states almost the obvious, but then it's like, oh, wow, that's actually a really good point to bring up.
Yeah. And I mean, I think about religious, like the most obvious example for me, you know, we were talking about ideologies and theocracy a few episodes ago, and if theocracy is a ideology that does exist, and the most obvious example that comes to my head would be something like the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is the head of state, the Ayatollah, is also the head of like the religious movement of Shia Islam and all this kind of stuff. And it's like, that's a good example. I think looking into that more, it's like, is that a particular kind of like religion sort of, for lack of a better way of saying it, infecting the government apparatus? Or is it like state party interested groups leveraging, you know, a widespread religious movement as social control, right? And basically making that an arm of the state. It's like that actually, I'm like, that maybe seems more accurate and more apt description of what goes on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think about something like the Inquisition or something like that, using religion in order to chase after or suppress, it's a political program with an ostensibly religious structure, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's a great example as well. I mean, it's a new and I think maybe more, I was going to say enlightened, I think that's a bit cheesy, but I guess you could say a more like enlightened way, a little bit more critical way of kind of looking at the problem. But why don't we jump into our reading for today? So again, for our listeners, we're going to be reading the preface of The Crisis of Narration by Bong Chiu-Han. And we're just going to read the preface. This is a few pages, and then we're kind of going to go through and have a little bit of like a discussion type episode. I'll do the reading. It'll just take us about probably 10 minutes or so, and then we can kind of get into it. So again, this is just the preface. So, preface to Crisis of Narration by Bong Chiu-Han. Everyone is talking about narratives. Paradoxically, the inflation of narrative betrays a crisis of narration. At the heart of all the noise of storytelling, there is a narrative vacuum that expresses itself in a lack of meaning and orientation. Neither storytelling nor the narrative turn will be able to bring about the return of narration. A paradigm becomes a topic and a fashionable object of academic research only when there is a deep-seated alienation from it. All the talk about narratives suggests their dysfunctionality. As long as narratives were our anchor in being, that is, as long as they provided us with a sight, turning being in the world into being at home by furnishing life with meaning, support, and orientation. In other words, as long as living was a narrating, there was never any talk of storytelling or narration. The inflation in the use of such concepts begins precisely when narratives lose their original power, their gravitational force, their secret, and their magic. Once they are seen as something constructed, they lose their moment of inner truth. They are considered contingent, exchangeable, modifiable. They are no longer the sources of what is binding, of what unites. They no longer anchor us in being. Despite the present hype around narratives, we live in a post-narrative time. Narrative consciousness, allegedly rooted in the human brain, is a conception that is possible only in a post-narrative time, that is, outside the narrative spell. Religion is a typical narrative with an inner moment of truth. It narrates contingency away. Christian religion is a meta-narrative that reaches into every nook and cranny of life and anchors it in being. Time itself becomes frightened with narrative. In the Christian calendar, each day is meaningful. In the post-narrative era, the calendar is denarrativized. It becomes a meaningless schedule, of appointments. Religious holidays are highlights and high points of a narrative. Without a narrative, there are no festivities, no festive times, no festive moods with their intensified feeling of being. All that is left are work and free time, production and consumption. and the post-narrative era festivities are commercialized. They become events and spectacles. Rituals are also narrative practices. They are always embedded in a narrative context. As symbolic techniques for creating enclosure, they transform being in the world into being at home. A world-changing and world-opening narrative cannot be created by the whim of a single person. Rather, it owes its existence to a complex process in which various forces and actors are involved. Ultimately, a narrative is an expression of the mood of a time. Such narratives, which have an inner moment of truth, are the opposite of the eviscerated, exchangeable, and contingent narratives, that is, the micro-narratives of the present, which lack gravity and which lack any moment of truth. Narration is a concluding form. It creates a closed order that founds meaning and identity. In late modernity, which is characterized by an opening up and unbounding, forms of concluding and closing off are increasingly eroded. At the same time, with increasing permissiveness comes a growing need for narrative forms of closure. Populist, nationalist, and right-wing extremist or tribal narratives, including conspiracy theories, cater to this need. They are taken up because they offer meaning and identity. However, in the post-narrative era, with its intensifying experience of contingency, these narratives do not have any strong binding force. Narratives create a community. Storytelling, by contrast, brings forth only a fleeting community, that the commodified form of community. These communities consist of consumers. No amount of storytelling could recreate the fire around which humans gather to tell each other stories. That fire has long since burnt out. It has been replaced by the digital screen, which separates people as individual consumers. Consumers are lonely. They do not form a community. Nor can the stories shared on social media fill the narrative vacuum. They are merely forms of pornographic self-presentation or self-promotion. Posting, liking, sharing content are consumerist practices that intensify the narrative crisis. Through storytelling, capitalism appropriates the narrative and submits it to consumption. Storytelling produces narratives in a consumable form. It charges products with emotion. It promises unique experiences. We buy, sell, and consume narratives and emotions. Stories sell. Storytelling is really story selling. Narration and information are counteracting forces. Information intensifies the experience of contingency, whereas narration reduces it by turning the accidental into necessity. Information lacks solidity of being. Nicholas Luhmann puts it lucidly, information's cosmology is not a cosmology of being, but of contingency. Being and information are mutually exclusive. A lack of being, a forgetfulness of being, is thus imminent to the information society. Information is additive and cumulative. It is not a bearer of sense, whereas narration carries sense. The original meaning of sense is direction. Today we are perfectly informed, but we lack orientation. Information also dissects time into mere sequences of present moments. A narrative, by contrast, brings forth a temporal continuum that is a story. On one hand, the informationization of society accelerates its denarrativization. On the other, amid the tsunami of information, there arises a need for meaning, identity, and orientation. That is, a need to clear the thick forest information in which we risk losing ourselves. The flood of ephemeral narratives, including conspiracy theories and the tsunami of information, are ultimately two sides of the same coin. Adrift in the sea of information and data, we seek a narrative anchor. We tell fewer and fewer stories in our everyday lives. Telling stories is in decline because communication takes the form of exchange information. Scarcely any stories are told on social media. Stories unite people by promoting their capacity for empathy. They create genuine community. The loss of empathy in the age of the smartphone is a clear sign that this technology is not a medium for telling stories. Its technical disposition is already a barrier to the telling of stories. Typing and swiping is not narrative gestures. A smartphone allows only for the accelerated exchange of information. Narrating presupposes close listening and deep attention. The narrative community is a community of attentive listeners, but we increasingly lack the patience for attentive listening, even the patience for narrative. When everything becomes contingent, fleeting, and accidental, and all that is binding and unifying dissolves, that is, in the current storm of contingency, there is a clamor for storytelling. The inflation of narration betrays a need to help to cope with contingency, but storytelling is unable to transform the information society, which is devoid of orientation and meaning, back into a stable narrative community. Rather, storytelling is a pathological phenomenon of our era. The narrative crisis has a long prehistory. This essay attempts to trace it. So that was the preface to Byung-Chul Han's The Crisis of Narration. I've read the whole book, by the way, for our listeners. So I can say that the preface touches on a lot of topics that are brought up in more detail throughout the book. It almost takes you kind of through like the kind of main key ideas. Brandon, exactly. That's why I thought it would be a good little read. Is there anywhere that you want to start off?
I think it's, so why don't we start right at the beginning? Everyone is talking about narratives. Paradoxically, the inflation of narrative betrays a crisis of narration. I find this an interesting sort of move that gets made by clearly Heideggerian influenced people. Byung-Chul Han obviously drawing on ideas like being in the world, being at home, etc. It's this idea that the crisis is that there is no crisis, right? Paradoxically, the inflation of narrative betrays a crisis of narration that, oh, well, we have stories all over the place. We've got stories on Instagram. People are posting all the time. You can go watch the news. You can go watch movies. You can go read books. But at the same time, the very fact that there is no sort of the fact that it's so full that you get what you want, that you're satisfied, almost is the crisis, right? Because if what Byung-Chul Han says is right about narration is the creation of meaning by arranging events, by drawing on one's memory of experiences and arranging them, that's not necessarily the same thing as just taking tidbits of information and creating like a thesis or something. But we don't have that. Not really. We don't really have people who sort of sift through these narratives and try to make sense of them. I guess Byung-Chul Han is doing that.
Yeah, I think one of the big things that jumps out for me, exactly with this turn, this is kind of like a classic turn a little bit, but it's like the idea that like the fact that we're constantly seeking narratives and looking for ways to inject our lives and communities and have them, you know, is that's a signal that like we're not living in the narrative anymore, right? That you're kind of, you know, a good example would be, now, and this is a kind of obvious because like religiosity has obviously historically had a good big component of narrative.